play just last turn. I thank God that he was summoning sick, but then my opponent just went untapped land go. Please, Lord, forgive me, cause he's gonna flip. Ah, who werewolves be flipping? Ah, who? Ah, who werewolves be flipping? Ah, who?
Latest episode of Lucky Paper Radio. I'm your host, Andy. I'm here, as always, with my co-host, Anthony Deathbonnet Sprout Maddox.
Hey, I like fungus cards. What can I say?
Do you like this fungus card enough to include it in your cube, even though it's a double-faced card?
No spoilers.
This is not just an episode where we talk about whether or not a card has been added to your cube. You can share your deep thoughts about it and its mechanics and power level later, but is it going in one of your cubes?
I'm not ready to break the double face card rule for myself yet.
Because you also didn't even include the fungus guy that has a land on the back from Zendikar Rising.
Yeah, it's just not worth it to
that
me.
Would be an easier include because it's at least a land on the back, but I see how it is.
We're not alone. Maybe for my mushroom cube.
Someday you'll have a mushroom cube.
I'm going to write that down.
Yeah, write that down in your copybooks.
Please ensure that you have your copybook at hand, as you'll be asked to take down notes from the screen at various points throughout the program.
This is our Innistrad Midnight Hunt set review, Anthony, and that means we are not alone. On this episode, we are joined by the one and only Parker Jet Crowdis Midnight Hunt Lamascus.
Does that mean, like, I'm imitating Jet, or I've replaced...
You're the sequel to Jet. You're, like, we're returning to the plane. You're the Jet sequel.
Jet is a double-faced card, and I'm the werewolf side.
Exactly. Jet is not long gone. He's not under a full moon and disappeared. Jet is just making himself and society better by getting a medical degree at medical school. Thus, he doesn't have time to always talk about magic cards, but Jet is still there in the background helping pull the strings and analyze data and stuff. So he's not gone from Lucky Paper Radio. Just doesn't have time to sit down and chat with us, but we are thrilled to have you with us, Parker. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I propose we dive right in. These episodes tend to go long. I think we should not dilly-dally at all and just get right to the cards of Innistrad Midnight Hunt. But first, we do need to talk a little bit about the scale we are going to be reviewing these cards by. So we're going to be reviewing the results from our set survey, which are going to be published in our set perspective alongside this episode. That article is great, written by Parker. You can find it in the show notes, so make sure to check that out. And in this survey, as people that are return listeners will know, we basically ask cube curators to tell us what cards they intend on playing in their cubes from the latest set and rate each of those cards on a scale from 1 to 3. 1 being a card that you're kind of skeptical about, but you're going to try out and see if it overperforms your expectations. 3 being a card you're really excited about, you expect it to be in your cube for a long time to come. And a 2 kind of right in the middle, as the numerical scale would imply. We're going to talk about our thoughts on these cards, of course, but we're also going to invoke the results from this survey, both for unrestricted cubes, peasant cubes, and pauper cubes. That unrestricted bin is by far the biggest because it counts any other type of novel restriction that is not just rarity restrictions. So that can be any kind of cube that can fall under that category as long as it's not rarity restricted. And then, of course, we have the rarity restricted cubes.
I would just add to that a huge thank you to everybody who submitted the survey. This has just been a fun way to engage with you all and see like what all you are doing.
Yeah, our results continue to grow. This is a record-setting survey for us. And I got to be honest, I thought that high watermark set by the Modern Horizons 2 survey was going to stand for some time because there was an inordinate amount of excitement in the community around Modern Horizons 2, and I thought we would reach more people there. But here we are, just 2 sets later, and we are breaking that record.
Very exciting.
One note about this particular set review. So in the past, we have done things mostly by color. Sometimes we'll pull out a cycle that is kind of grouped together and talk about them as a group. But with this set, for whatever reason, I think it just breaks down more cleanly by theme, by cycle. So we're really going to be talking about this set, not in color order strictly. We do have very robust annotated linked show notes that you can find on the website. So if you want to jump around this episode, the best place to listen to this episode is going to be in your web browser on that page where you can just click on a title of a section and jump right to it, whether it's a specific card discussion or a category theme discussion.
And we're not going to talk about every single card. We've pulled out some things both that from the survey were cards that drew a lot of attention, as well as some other things that we think are interesting or highlight something that's unique about the set. And hopefully that'll be a good jumping off point just to talk about the set as a whole and what it offers for us as cube designers.
Correct. All right, now let's tally no further, Anthony. Let's get to our first cards.
All right, so there's a big chunk of cards that I think I want to talk about right away, which is a whole bunch of cards that are kind of just like strict upgrades in a power level sense from classic staple cards. So first up, we have Play with Fire. So this is one red mana for an instant, deals 2 damage to any target, and if you target a player, you get to scry 1. So this is just, again, in a power level sense, a strict upgrade from Shock, because it does the same thing, but if you happen to use it in this sort of like less ideal mode, where, you know, usually in a lot of games you want to be targeting creatures, but if you do happen to target a player, you get to scry 1, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, and this is being tested by about 31% of both of our unrestricted respondents and our peasant respondents.
We also have Consider, which is 1 blue mana for basically surveil 1 draw a card. So look at the top card of your library. You can put it in your graveyard or leave it on top and then draw a card. So
Opt but different.
And I would argue in almost any case, this is just a strict upgrade. I'm always looking for ways to interact with the graveyard and fuel interactions there. So this is just like an awesome. This is honestly a card that I've just wanted to see ever since they printed Surveil, if not sooner. So that's exciting. I kind of wish it was keyworded just for that beautiful simplicity that Opt has, but I'll still take it.
I was bending over backwards trying to think of circumstances where Opt was better than Consider, and the only one I could come up with...
You're about to mill yourself.
Well, no. I mean, I guess, sure. That does matter, I guess. That's even more narrow. The only like somewhat reasonable one I could come up with is you're playing like a combo deck that has specific cards you need in your library for tutor reasons that you don't want to draw. So like you're playing your Reanimator deck, you Consider and see your Grizzlebrand on top. Well, I guess that's Reanimator's a bad example because you obviously want Grizzlebrand in the graveyard. What's another
Oath
combo?
Of, you're playing an Oath of Druids
there
combo
you go.
Deck.
You're playing Oath of Druids, but if you see Emrakul, it's going to go into your library anyway. There are some very narrow applications where you might want Opt over Consider, but for the most part, it's a straight upgrade. So I don't think we need to talk too much about each of these cards individually, mm-hmm. I should say, because they're powerful. People are cubing them a lot because they're known quantities, I think. Like some of the cards that perform the best on this survey are cards that don't have a lot of uncertainty surrounding them. And if you already know you like Opt, then you certainly know you're going to like Consider, assuming right. You don't have some restriction barring you from running it.
We also have basically just an upgrade on Go for the Throat, where you lose 2 life instead of having the limitation or, you know, this whole classic collection of cards that are 2 mana for a black removal spell that has some restriction. This loses 2 life instead, which is arguably, in a lot of contexts, much more powerful, as well as an unsummon with a little bit of an upside and another cheap red 1 mana 2/1 with some upside. So there's all kinds of these little upgrades. But I'm using the word upgrade strictly in the sort of power level sense.
Right.
A big part of what I enjoy about cube design is not just saying, well, let's go look at the most powerful cards and put them in a cube together, because that's kind of what every other format, every other way to play Magic is about. And for me, cube really is this place where you get to sort of experience game design in a big way and choose how these components that really their power level only matters how they relate to each other work and explore that game design aspect of Magic. So for me personally, I'm really interested in Consider because I think it, you know, from a mechanical standpoint, does something very cool that just allows for a new kind of interaction where you have this really cheap, efficient spell that fuels your graveyard. And I think that's awesome. I'm also pretty interested in the unsummon with upside specifically because in my main cube, unsummon is just not quite getting there. It's not quite powerful enough. So I do want to turn that knob and turn it up a little bit. But a lot of these other ones I'm actually not so interested in because I don't think that extra complexity is actually contributing to more interesting decisions and more fun gameplay. So especially the Shock, it's like, that's cool, but how often is that going to come up and be meaningful in my particular cube?
Yeah, I would largely agree. I think of these cards, I agree I'm really excited about Consider. I'm in love with Infernal Grasp as somebody that just does not like the other Doomblades with somewhat what feel to me like arbitrary restrictions.
That's a great point.
We can have a very long conversation, a very long and nerdy conversation about what precisely is the difference between a card that is restricted based on color versus a card that is restricted based on mana cost versus a card that is restricted based on type line? To me, there's like a scale of how arbitrary those restrictions feel. You could also just argue that those restrictions, how arbitrary they are, doesn't matter. All that matters is what percentage of cards they hit and how good those cards are. In either case, I really like Infernal Grasp as a very, very clean example of a Doomblade style effect, and one where I think the life loss is going to matter. I think that extra text is not irrelevant. It's going to be a little better in proactive decks, a little worse in control decks, but still very playable, obviously. And I like it for that reason.
Overall, I would just underscore this by saying it's great that we have even more flexibility in these slightly different options. So whatever your cube design goals, there's just more choices for you now.
The one other card that we should talk about here that I think is a little bit different, but in the similar category, is Fateful Absence. This is one and a white for an instant that destroys target creature or planeswalker, and its controller investigates. So this is not a strict upgrade over anything in particular. It is very reminiscent of Declaration in Stone, which was from Shadows over Innistrad, or one of the previous Innistrad sets. Can't remember if it's Eldritch Moon or Shadows, but either way, which destroyed a creature and all creatures with the same name and caused their controller to investigate and couldn't hit planeswalkers and was a sorcery instead. So it's not a strict upgrade, because in the sense that you can't hit big swaths of tokens or creatures that happen to have the same name, but I think it's an upgrade more or less practically. I'm really excited for more planeswalker removal. I also just really like cards like this that are efficient but have a downside. And here, you know, it's not card advantage. This card is strictly a tempo advantage, right? You're getting rid of an opponent's threat. They're going to replace that at the cost of 2 mana. I think it's a powerful card, but it's not a blowout. It's not just like hyper-efficient removal with no downside. So I really like the design of that card. And cube designers generally agree it's being tested by around 67% of the unrestricted cube designers, which are, of course, the only rare restriction that can run this card. So one of the more popular cards, second most popular card in the entire survey.
Yeah, and you also raised an interesting point, which I think we can just sort of broadly apply to a lot of the removal spells in this set, as well as other very recent sets, where more and more we're seeing this line of text, destroy target creature or planeswalker, which I think for a lot of cube designers who are running a lot of planeswalkers, I actually find that to be a benefit to have that option. So something else to look out for.
Actually, it brings up an interesting point, and this is the one thing that I kind of wish Jet was here for. No offense to you, Parker, but I know Jet has historically been always wanting more and more planeswalker removal, and I think this is a weird tension where part of what makes planeswalkers different from creatures, right, is that there shouldn't be as much removal for them as there are for creatures. At least that's in my opinion. Maybe I'm wrong about that, and maybe that can be disproven by what planeswalkers are going to become in 5-10 years. But right now, it feels to me like a planeswalker should be harder to remove with a spell than a creature if you look at Magic as a whole. And so as we get more and more of these effects, which we're just going to keep getting more of this, right, because Standard rotates all the time. There's going to have to be some density of planeswalker interaction in Standard, presumably, to make that format work. And if we just keep adding all the planeswalker removal and don't add any more removal that can only destroy creatures, eventually planeswalkers and creatures will be equally susceptible to removal in cubes, and planeswalkers will just be like variable ETB creatures almost in that sense. I actually feel like I'm very happy with the amount of planeswalker interaction in my cube right now. I have no desire for them to, like, I don't feel like it's a hole that I'm wanting them to fill like I maybe used to 2 years ago or something. Parker, do you have thoughts on this like relationship between planeswalkers and removal and the density of removal we have for them in our environments?
Yeah, I personally don't feel a need for more spells that kill planeswalkers because I already have, I don't know, about 100 spells which kill planeswalkers, and they are creatures.
I thought you were going to say burn spells, but creatures also work. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I do run burn spells, but creatures really do this job of killing planeswalkers extremely efficiently. I mean, even when we had Jace the Mind Sculptor in Standard, the perfect foil to that planeswalker was Bloodbraid Elf, because you got a tempo advantage of the Cascade trigger, and you got to kill Jace immediately with next to no downside. That dynamic still exists in cubes. And for that reason, I just don't have that much stake in it.
Yeah, I agree. And I think as my cube has gotten more aggressive, all of the planeswalkers have gone down in value just because there's more likely your opponent's going to have a big board and you're not going to be able to just stick it and run away with the game. So yeah, I don't feel like this is a hole anymore, though I am excited for this very flexible spell with that specific letting your opponent investigate when you destroy their thing, which is a downside I really like, again, because I think it balances things out and says you can't just, you know, sit there and sling removal spells and do nothing. It says take advantage of this tempo advantage you have.
You know what else? This didn't get the arena treatment of destroy target creature your opponent controls, so you can even cycle this for 4 and the cost of 1 creature if you really need to.
I mean, that will come up. I was going to say, Anthony, that we've already played with a couple of these cards in my cube, and I had the Scry 1 on Play with Fire matter and potentially change the outcome of a game in like one of the five games I played with it.
I love that.
Which is interesting. I got to be honest, I don't think I'm going to keep Play With Fire in my cube because it's not just not doing it for me. It's not sparking the joy. It's not enough variation on a burn spell. It just feels like you just slot it in as another burn spell, obviously, and just play it. And I really want to make use of all of the slots in my cube for a wide range of effects. And so I think that might become Pyrite Spellbomb, but that's a conversation for later, perhaps.
I do want to say that Fateful Absence is the second most popular card among unrestricted testers. However, that's not true globally. So we see that our peasant and pauper respondents actually swung the scale in favor of cards like Infernal Grasp and even Cathar Commando. These were extremely popular cards among that segment. And so globally, the order changes. Fateful Absence is not the global second most popular card, and that's thanks to our rarity restricted cube curators. So if you've ever wondered whether your odd or rarity restricted cube matters, it does, and this is one example of that.
Hey, it's not just about number of friends you have that determine whether or not you matter. Every cube matters already.
Mm-hmm.
Next up, we're going to talk about the adversary cycle. This was, I feel like we're getting, in most recent sets, like a cycle of mythics that almost the whole cycle is appealing on some level to a wide swath of cube designers. I'm thinking of like the mythic double-faced lands from Zendikar. I'm thinking of the Evoke Elementals from Modern Horizons 2. In this set, the powerful mythic cycle is this cycle of adversaries. So all of these cards are creature spells, and they have an ability that kind of resembles a multi-kicker-esque ability. It's functionally different in the sense that it doesn't require you to pay an extra cost on cast, but when the creature ETBs, you can pay an additional cost any number of times, and you get some effect for the number of times you pay it. I'll run down the rules text of these cards, and then we'll talk about the popularity of them respectively, and what we think about this mechanic. So the white one is Intrepid Adversary. It's one and a white for a 3/1 with lifelink, and for its ability, you can pay one and a white any number of times, and for each time you do, it gets a valor counter, and then for each valor counter on it, creatures you control get +1/+1. So it's basically a 3/1 with lifelink that comes with a scalable anthem effect that just kind of goes up as you pay more and more mana. Spectral Adversary is the blue one. This is one and a blue for a 2/1 with flash and flying. And for its ability, you can pay one and a blue any number of times. And for each time it's paid, you put that many +1/+1 counters on it, and you phase out that many other target creatures, artifacts, or enchantments. Kind of a weird way to like protect some of your own stuff or potentially phase out some blockers of your opponents, like a temporary resetting of things. The fact that it has flash means you can fizzle removal spells and stuff or save creatures in combat if you want to. Kind of a funky tempo card there. The black one is Tainted Adversary. This is one and a black for a 2/3 with Death Touch. Its kicker ability is two and a black, so three instead of two. And for each time you pay that, it gets that many +1/+1 counters, and you make that many 2/2 black zombie creature tokens with Decayed. The red one is Bloodthirsty Adversary, one and a red for a 2/2 with haste, and its ability costs two and a red, so three mana total. And each time you pay that, it gets that many +1/+1 counters, and you exile that many target instant or sorcery cards with mana value 3 or less from your graveyard and copy them, and you may cast those copies this turn without paying their mana costs. So kind of like a Goblin Dark Dwellers at the 5 and up mana mode on the red one with the floor of a 2/2 with haste, which is not terrible for 2 mana. And finally, Primal Adversary is the green one. 2 and a green, so 3 mana for a 4/3 with trample. And for its kicker ability, you can pay 1 and a green any number of times. And for each time you do it, you put a +1/+1 counter on it. And you have target land you control become a 3/3 wolf creature with haste, and it's still a land. Doesn't put counters on it, doesn't untap it, it just makes a land you control a 3/3 wolf creature with haste. I'm only noticing just as I read these abilities that the white one is the only one that doesn't get +1/+1 counters, and I guess it's because it pumps itself virtually with its own ability, which is kind of a weird thing. I only just noticed as I read them all back to back.
Interesting implementation detail.
Yeah. Parker, what do you think of this adversary cycle overall?
You know, I think they are perfectly powerful. We've talked at length at Lucky Paper about how powerful modal effects are and scalable threats, and that's what all of these do. However, personally, for my own cube, I am not really convinced by the number of words on each of these cards. So I'm
it's a lot of words.
Yeah. I have to admit I fell asleep while you were reading them. And as a result, I will not be including them in my cube.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think there's sort of a balance where is the actual complexity worth it? Is it actually, mm-hmm. is that complexity adding meaningful amount of fun to the experience? And I think for a lot of people, the answer is going to be yes. Like, I think there's a lot of interesting lines, interesting interactions between these cards. And like you said, scalable threats do offer a lot to the kinds of options that you have during a game. So I think they will be appealing to a lot of cube designers. For me personally, I'm at the same point where I don't think that complexity is quite bringing enough to the table.
Yeah. And of course, I don't blame anybody who does run them and enjoy them. But I think even at those upper echelons of cube power level, like I pursue, and I know Andy does as well, I think we can pick and choose at this point between which powerful threats we want, unless our cubes are just like enormous.
Yeah, I mean, and truthfully, you could always pick and choose, right? But I think mm-hmm. people are now finding that there is perhaps a bigger swath of cards that are mutually playable without being power level liabilities that exactly. they can actually choose from. For my part, I love scalable cards, and I actually think the complexity on these cards reads more complicated than it is. Like, it's very easy to shortcut once you know the cards, and yes, that does have the bias towards people that actually know the cards they're playing with, but to be honest, most of my play group that I play my cube with regularly is going to know these cards for the most part, and if they can't, they obviously read it to remind themselves. And then once you read it, like, these cards do play very simply, right? I think they actually have simple play patterns. It's not like it's going to be some complicated rules interaction
right.
you don't understand.
The fact that mm-hmm. the complexity is when you cast the card, or, you know, if we're being real specific, when they enter the battlefield. So once they're in play, you resolve the effect. There's not a ton of complexity for the most part to keep track of.
Yeah. Sure. So I like them. So just in terms of the responses from the community, the red one is actually the most popular, which is about 60% of our respondents testing the red one. I honestly didn't expect that, but the red one is probably the one I like the most as well, because the floor on it, I think, is the most respectable. I'm very happy with a 2-2 with haste for one and a red in my any kind of red deck, frankly. And I particularly like that the way this card scales up is going to be dependent on the kind of deck you've built. Like, what mm. this card can do at 5 mana is going to be different depending on how you've drafted and built around it, what kinds of mana value 3 or less spells you have in your deck. So obviously, you know, getting a burn spell back is going to be pretty common because it's also in red and it's going to happen pretty often. But also getting a removal spell from black, I imagine at some point someone's going to, like, flashback balance with this thing. That's going to happen, right? Or Toxic Deluge in some weird kind of control deck. I just like that the way it scales up is somewhat flexible. Right on its heels, though, is Intrepid Adversary, the white one, with 55% of our cube designers that responded to the survey testing that one. This is the one I expected to be the most popular, to be honest, and right behind the red one here. I do think this one is interesting in the fact that it can turn an otherwise stalled game where your aggro deck has gotten kind of brickwalled into a game you can actually win again. If your opponent has stopped you by playing, you know, 3/3s and 4/4 blockers in their mid-range deck, you can get to a point in the game where you get to cast this and then all of a sudden you have favorable attacks again, which I think is cool. And that's what I want from a scalable card in my aggro deck. The green one is the next most popular, and that's with 35% of people testing it. And this one, I think, is my second favorite, because I think green is the color I most look for scalable threats in, because that's the color in my environment where you're most likely to have just a bunch of extra mana to dump into it. I gotta admit, this is the one that kind of bums me out in terms of the way the card functions. I don't like that it turns lands into creatures without indicating it in some way. You know, I'm comparing this to something like Nissa Who Shakes the World and puts +1/+1 counters on the land, I think, is much cleaner. And the fact that the lands stay tapped, they do gain haste, is kind of weird. I mean, obviously you can put it on a land that's untapped, but like, that kind of confluence is kind of strange. And there's going to be this tension, which I can't decide if it's an interesting strategic tension or if it's just a distraction, that it's a scalable card, so you're going to want to dump all of your mana into it if you have a bunch of mana. But is that correct to do when all those lands are going to be tapped? You're opening yourself up to actually losing all of your lands or a chunk of your lands in a board wipe situation. So this one's got like some kind of edge complexity. I would have liked it a lot more if it had been maybe a little bit toned down in power level, but just made creature tokens instead of turning your lands into creatures, or had some other kind of the weird edges sanded off there. And then the last two, the blue and the black ones, are the least popular, with 28% and 19% of people testing those cards respectively. Still in the top 20 cards of the set across the entire set, but not as popular as the other cards in the adversary cycle.
I wonder if the popularity of the red and white ones are due to like the perception of white and red aggressive decks. These are both aggressive leaning creatures, and often I hear like a desire for more quote unquote interesting, or I guess how that translates is cards with unique mechanics in aggressive strategies. And I think that's probably a component of these cards' popularity.
Yeah, I think so too. I especially like the red one, I think is a really good example of how I like to think about scalable cards in my own environment. So you might think these occupy like a 2-drop slot, right? Because the white and red one are both 2-drops, so the 2-drop cards. And very often, I think you'll play both of them as 2-drops, probably the majority of the time for both of them in most environments. I really like them for the fact that if you actually imagine Bloodthirsty Adversary as effectively a 5-drop with a 2-mana secondary mode, like it just basically can replace a Goblin Dark Dweller is in a cube where you don't mind this complexity, you don't mind the extra text, you don't mind the little bit of additional power level, and it gives you that additional mode of like, if you want to, you can play it as a 2-2 with haste. And that's how I always look at scalable cards, right? I think people oftentimes slot them into their cheapest mode as the mana cost of the card, but to me, having Primal Adversary in my deck, it's like, now I've got a 5-drop, a 7-drop, a 9-drop, all the way up to however many I want. Same goes for these other cards. So that's the one note I'd make about how people think about these cards and how they slot into their environments, is that like you might want to cut a 5-drop for Intrepid Adversary or Bloodthirsty Adversary, and you're not giving up anything by doing that, right? Because you can play these cards as 5-drops. It's not like you're losing a 5-drop from your cube by doing it that way.
Daybound Nightbound is one of the marquee mechanics of Innistrad Midnight Hunt. A Daybound card has the text, if a player casts no spells during their own turn, it becomes night next turn. And then Nightbound is, if a player casts at least 2 spells during their own turn, it becomes day next turn. So it all depends on how many spells you cast. And the important thing here is that if it's night, a Daybound creature will enter Nightbound, pre-flipped, in other words. And this is the werewolf mechanic of the set. The most popular card with Daybound, Nightbound, is Suspicious Stowaway. It's 1 and a blue for a creature, human, rogue, werewolf. Suspicious Stowaway cannot be blocked, and whenever it deals combat damage to a player, draw a card, then discard a card. It has Daybound, and when it flips, it becomes Seafaring Werewolf, which can't be blocked. It's a 2-1 werewolf, and whenever it deals combat damage to a player, draw a card, no discard.
And then there's a couple other cards here too, but before we get to those, I'm curious to know, Parker, Anthony and I talked about this in our Midnight Hunt Mechanics episode, which people can go back and listen to. What do you think of Daybound Nightbound in a cube that doesn't support it entirely as a theme? And looking at the results of our survey here, there are a number of cards that break into the sort of most popular cards, but so if people are running those, you know, that most of the respondents that are going to run Suspicious Stowaway are not going to have a Daybound Nightbound theme in their cube. How do you think this mechanic plays in that context, Parker?
Right. I think it's got a weird like complexity distribution where if you only have one, it's not a big deal. It's just like learning the text for any other functionally unique card. Let's say you only have one Cascade card. Well, you'd have to learn some text that's not necessarily printed on the card because Cascade has been eroded and it doesn't do what it says. In the same way, if this is your only Daybound Nightbound card, no big deal. You just learn one rule. But if you've got a couple of them and they're interspersed with werewolves from the original Innistrad or Shadows over Innistrad, I think that's the peak of complexity. And then once you include enough so that they become a theme, again, that becomes less complex because you can shortcut any future Daybound Nightbound cards.
Anthony, I'm curious to know if your thoughts on this mechanic have changed at all now that you've played with it. We talked about this in our mechanics episode like 3 weeks ago, and you were like, seems like a great implementation, really like it. You weren't even that worried about including 1 or 2 or 3 odd cards like this with Daybound Nightbound in a cube that otherwise doesn't have it as a mechanic. Do you still feel like this mechanic works in that context?
Context.
I mean, it definitely works. I think the like key thing where something actually feels really clunky is if you know, your creature dies, it's in the graveyard, it's the only Daybound Nightbound card you have. You do technically still need to track it for the rest of the game, just in case you have a regrowth or something. And you and I, we try and be spikes and play precise, and actually saying like, oh, it doesn't matter, I don't have a regrowth in my deck, is giving away some meaningful information.
And in some cubes, your opponent could have a way to put it back in your library. Like,
oh, yeah,
they
totally
could be running a time spiral or something.
Or a commit to memory.
Right. You know, I think it depends how casually you're playing. And I think, honestly, a lot of people play cube pretty casually and are probably very happy to say, I'll give up that 0.5% of edge.
Like, I think that it is really easy for me to be overstating how important that is. I think that like it would be really easy to shortcut that away or just ignore it or whatever and still have good games of Magic.
Yeah, but if you are a stickler for the rules, if you are in a spikier group, I think that you do have to just play it that way. And yeah, that is, I think, a big detriment. I'll also say for individual cards, like if you're just playing Suspicious Stowaway in your cube and nothing else with Daybound Nightbound, having the token around just seems annoying, but you probably should.
I like having tokens.
I mean, I guess you can just flip it and its state can be the indicator of Day-Night now because it's the one Daybound Nightbound card, and so you don't need another game piece to indicate that. I was very skeptical of it in a context outside of mid-limited or outside of a place where you've designed a cube with Daybound Nightbound as a theme, and I gotta say, since playing with it, I'm only more skeptical and feel like it's kind of rough. And I say that as somebody that really likes Arlen the Pack's Hope. Can you give us the rules text on Arlen, Parker?
Sure. Arlen is a 2 red green legendary planeswalker, Arlen. She has Daybound. She has a +1 ability. Until your next turn, you may cast creature spells as though they had flash. Each creature you control enters the battlefield with an additional +1/+1 counter on it. She has a -3 ability. Create 2/2 green wolf creature tokens. And then on her reverse face, she has Nightbound, +2 loyalty ability to add red green, and a 0 ability. Until end of turn, she becomes a 5/5 werewolf creature with trample, indestructible, and haste. She starts with 4 loyalty.
I really like this card from a mechanical perspective. I think the plus ability, when you cast things at instant speed, is a cool ability. The minus ability is obviously the main mode of this card. I think in most contexts, you play her, you make 2/2 wolves, you all of a sudden have a great board to protect her. What I really like about her is that she also just enables you flipping the card, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you can switch it tonight by just upticking her. If you're only casting creature spells, you're not giving up any equity because you can cast those creature spells in your opponent's turn now, and you get to flip her and then have a huge creature to attack with the next turn. So I think this card is very cool, and it also has the upside of being the only non-creature with Daybound Nightbound, which means that compared to something like Suspicious Stowaway, there are substantially fewer ways in most cubes to get a planeswalker back from your graveyard than there are to get creatures back. So maybe it's even easier to just be casual about it and not track Day-Night after this thing has left the battlefield. But it might just be too much for me still. I might just not end up playing this card for that reason alone, because I think the mechanic is just not really well suited to singleton environments, cubes with cards from a wide variety of sets. It doesn't really slot nicely into Magic more broadly.
Yeah, it's interesting. It kind of reminds me of a conversation we've had before about ability words and how they don't actually add any text that is meaningful to the card. So in the context of a cube where you have only one card that has a particular ability word, it's actually adding more complexity because it doesn't let you do the shortcutting thing you can when you have a whole bunch of cards with, for example, Battle Cry on them in one set. And I think this is similar, where actually the one of cards from the previous implementation of werewolves actually do make more sense, even though I do think that in a lot of ways this implementation is a lot cleaner.
It's a much more flavorful implementation when you're playing with a lot of these cards. The right idea that it is now night, as opposed to the cards individually caring about whether or not it's effectively day or effectively night, is not as flavorful, but certainly the original werewolf mechanic works really nicely just to play Huntmaster of the Fells in your regular deck otherwise, and it works just fine.
Yeah. I do really love the flavor on Arlen specifically, though, how the actual mechanic sort of enhances and implies that sort of cycle of day and night where it's like, okay, Arlen's here, let's do nothing. Let's wait till nighttime, and then all the wolves come out.
Right, exactly.
And you know what I just noticed now? Both of Arlen's plus abilities help fuel the flip to the other side. Andy already mentioned the flash ability, but her reverse face adds red-green to your mana pool, which will enable double spelling in an extremely easy manner. Which,
yeah, if you wanted to flip back, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, that's a really compact, neat design. And the other thing I love about it, which unfortunately we can't really communicate through an aural medium, but the showcase art on this card is gorgeous.
It is exceptional.
I'm going to be playing this card just for the art. Well, actually, I think the card's good, but the art sure helps.
It doesn't hurt. It doesn't hurt when it's got a nice picture on it. We're going to group all of the Daybound, Nightbound cards here, because I think this mechanic is going to be divisive. I think there are people that are going to be playing it, some people that are going to be avoiding it a priori, and no matter how cool the cards look or how well they fit in their cubes, because they don't like the mechanic. So Do you want to hit these last couple Daybound, Nightbound cards that were standouts on the survey, Parker?
Sure. The other top performing Daybound, Nightbound cards are Tovalar's Huntmaster, which is a 4GG, 6/6 human werewolf. When it enters, create 2/2 green wolf creature tokens. And when it flips with Daybound, it becomes a pack leader, which triggers the wolf ability when it attacks as well as enters. And it has 2GG to make a wolf fight a creature you don't control.
Grave Titan, but way more complicated and in green and probably not quite as good, but gets a little bit of a power boost for being in green because easier to cast than it would be in a black deck normally.
Yeah. Okay, the next most popular is Brutal Cathar, which is a creature, human soldier, werewolf. For 2W, it's a 2/2, and when it enters or transforms into Brutal Cathar, exile target creature an opponent controls until this creature leaves the battlefield. And it flips into Moonrage Brute, 3/3 werewolf with first strike, ward, pay 3 life, and nightbound. And one of the things I want to point out about Brutal Cathar is I compared the percentage of cube designers who are testing Brutal Cathar, which is 23%, to the percentage for the most recent, like, near analog I could find, which was Skyclave Apparition from Zendikar Rising. And it's being tested by about 30% of the respondents who responded to that survey. And I'm thinking these cards are very functionally similar, but Brutal Cathar is being tested by only 2/3 of the people, which makes me think that's maybe the tax that this double-faced technology is paying among cube designers. I think if I had to guess, I would say about 1/3 of the people who might have tested these double-faced cards aren't doing so for reasons of complexity, like Andy mentioned, or just aesthetics.
I think that's a pretty good estimate in terms of the best we can do from the data we have. I gotta say, I usually don't love Banisher Priest-style cards, and the reason I don't love them is because it contributes to this, like, I think players that like the kind of, like, on-edge, high-risk, high-reward gameplay maybe like them more, because every time I cast one, I feel like, okay, I got a creature now, but I have to be so precious with this creature because I can't lose it, because if I lose it, then it just gives them back the thing that I took from them with the Banisher Priest under rare circumstances. So I really like that Brutal Cathar flips into a creature that is both hard to remove with the spell because it has the ward ability, or at least makes you pay a cost to remove it with the spell with the ward ability, and also hard to remove in combat as a 3-power creature with first strike. So even though I don't usually like Banisher Priest variants, I also don't like this mechanic, surprisingly, you combine the two, and I kind of like this card more than most other Banisher Priests and more than most other cards with this mechanic. That said, still not going to make my testing list, but I did observe that about this card, that it kind of solves for one of the things that I usually gives me pause about these kinds of Banisher Priest cards.
For sure. Okay, so the last Daybound Nightbound card on our list is Outland Liberator. It's a 1GG, 2/2 human werewolf. You can pay 1 and sacrifice the creature to destroy target artifact or enchantment. It has Daybound, and it flips into a 3/3 werewolf that has the same ability, but it also gains whenever Frenzied Trapbreaker attacks, destroy target artifact or enchantment defending player controls. So I think this is being valued as an analog to Thrashing Brontodon or Reclamation Sage, or even Cathar Commando from this set, as a way to push damage, but also have a disenchant as an emergency tool.
This one was the heartbreaker for me because I would love a 1GG 2/2 with 1 naturalized something and any other kind of upside. But the upside on this card specifically adds to that complexity and makes you track this game mode and has a double face card. You have to read the backside in the draft. It's like the only kind of upside that would make me not excited about this card. So this one kind of bummed me out a little bit, I got to be honest.
Yeah, I agree with you.
So I think it's interesting that of all of these Daybound, Nightbound cards, Suspicious Stowaway is far and away the most popular. It's actually one of the most tested cards from the set altogether.
Yeah, 42% of our unrestricted testers testing that one.
And I think what I would point to is, just like this other group of cards, in many ways this card is a known quantity. It's sort of a power level upgrade from Lutherial Core. So I think a lot of people are looking at this and saying, well, I know how Lutherial Core plays. It's a card I enjoy, so let's just power it up a little bit more. And yeah, it has as well that combination of familiarity being a known quantity and also being very cheap to cast. And those are all hallmarks of the cards that we always see rise to the top.
Yeah, it is interesting that Lutero Core is also just impossibly clean. I guess Shadow is not that clean, depending on how you think about clean. Exactly one card with Shadow is kind of rough, maybe. I see people forget they can't block with it sometimes because that doesn't come up very often. And when it does, it can be a bit of a feel bad. And you're trading it for a card that has all this extra text. If I was still on Lutero Core, I would be pained to try and upgrade to this card because of how much extra stuff it has going on that I think is not going to come up that often in most games.
All right, I think we should talk briefly about Disturb. So you asked about this Mushroom Man, and he's not quite taking me off of my plan of not including double face cards. But Disturb is actually the mechanic that is most appealing of all of the double face mechanics that we've seen in every single set where they keep piling them in. So example card, this is not a super powerful card, but just a simple thing to give us something to talk about. We have Baithook Angler, which is a 2-mana 2/1. It's got Disturb for 2, so when it's in the graveyard, you can pay 2 mana, and it comes back as a 1/2 flyer. And if it dies, you exile it. So it's just a really tidy. We've seen all these other implementations of this idea of, well, I can have flashback on my creature. I can cast my creature from my graveyard one time. But two things I really love about this. One, it's just so much easier to track than, say, Embalm, because you don't have to add these extra tokens or put counters on it. Like, it's really obvious state change to remember right when it goes into exile.
Anybody that's played with Embalm knows that 95% of Cube players just use the card from their graveyard anyway.
Yeah,
as the representation of it.
And then giving it flying, I think it's just a really nice play pattern where you have this thing you can play early, and then late game it can actually get in some extra damage, and maybe discarding it to actually get that card with flying is really appealing. And what I really love about it is you know everything if you've played a Disturb card just looking at the front face of this card. There's no hidden information because you know it's coming back as a flyer. You see the backside's power and toughness. So I don't think I'm quite there yet, but I'm looking at this mechanic and thinking this is maybe what would break me and push me to add some double face cards.
Yeah, and we talked again more about this mechanic at length in our mechanic episode. Here I want to touch on the fact that really, none of these cards were popular amongst Cube designers.
Yeah, I think there was one person testing this particular card.
There wasn't any card with this mechanic that really showed up meaningfully on our survey, which I am kind of a little bummed we didn't get some more pushed examples of this mechanic, some, you know, mythic rares with the powerful version of this. I think part of that is because it is a really clean mechanic, like you said, Anthony. Like, how excited are you about a mythic rare that what makes it mythic is just that it comes back from the graveyard as a flyer with a different power and toughness. And
I'm pretty excited personally.
I would be pretty excited about it too, but I imagine it's the kind of thing some players would not be interested in. So yeah, this mechanic seems like it was a flop amongst Cube designers, but I do agree, Anthony, that it is, I think, one of my favorite double face card mechanics, and hopefully maybe shows up again in the future, or maybe people stop designing just power motivated cubes and we see more people exploring cards for mechanical and gameplay reasons, because I literally like this mechanic as a clean flashback for creatures.
Right. And one of the drawbacks is because every one of these cards with this mechanic has basically draw a card stapled to it, they do have to balance them. So the front
not
half
unlike
of
flashback
it,
though.
That's true. But I mean, that's also a problem with flashback, I think, is that a lot of players look at it and they say, well, that flashback cost is insanely expensive. But that's just how they have to cost it, so it is at an appropriate power level. But that gut reaction to it looking less powerful than it actually is a downside in terms of making cards that are appealing and people are excited about.
And yet, people love flashback.
They do.
Although I will note, too, while we're talking about it, basically no cards with flashback really making it in our survey either. I don't think we're talking about any today, maybe one. They didn't get there in terms of the people that are listening to this podcast and the cubes they're designing.
Okay, so should we take it by color for the remaining cards?
I think so. Yeah, let's go by color for the rest of the cards we have to talk about that don't fit into one of these buckets we've kind of already covered.
Cool. I'll start with white and Cathar Commando. It's a 1 and a white creature, human soldier, 3/1. It has flash, and it has 1, sacrifice Cathar Commando to destroy target artifact or enchantment. This is actually a hugely popular card among our peasant and pauper cube curators. And it does pretty impressively among unrestricted curators as well. It has an average rank of about 2.3, which is almost in that range that we call a staple in our methodology.
It's 78% of the pauper testers, 71% of the peasant testers, and 55% of the unrestricted testers are all playing this card. Parker, are you among them?
I am not. And I think it's mostly that my format really doesn't revolve around this 2 mana for 3 power kind of threshold. I try to put that power at the 1 mana slot with like Wild Nacatl and creatures of that nature. So I think the stats are a little outclassed in my environment, but who knows? Maybe I'll change my tune.
I couldn't find a cut for this card, even though on its face, I like it. And so I find myself at a little bit of an impasse. I don't know how relevant the flash is going to be here. On its face, like, you could just play this in a controlling deck that doesn't really want cheap creatures and just basically treat it as a Gideon's Reproach style removal spell for a non-flying attacker where you can basically deal three damage to it, or you can treat it as a three mana disenchant that you can, you know, play the creature and then activate the ability all at instant speed. I don't know. It isn't sparking something for me, but I understand why it's popular, and it seems very pushed to me just in terms of raw stats for an uncommon.
Yeah, cards. It's actually a common.
Right, of course.
So for my point, I really do like this card. I love how much modality you get out of what comes down to a pretty simple card. And I also think it's interesting. I don't know if this applies universally to all designers. Obviously, it doesn't, because nothing does. But making more main deckable artifact enchantment removal, I think you can also see that as a downside. But for a lot of cube designs, I think that is going to be an upside.
I love it. I don't know. Something about all these pieces coming together. Like, I would be more excited about the green one if it didn't have Daybound Nightbound than I think I am about Cathar Commando. And it's weird. I can't really explain why. Other than, I think in the aggressive decks in my environment, it's not so much about having to remove everything as it is just beating your opponent in spite of the things they have all the time. Whereas I feel like my green decks to go up against, the green deck's going to have to disenchant the Primordial Mist to win. The aggro deck might be able to just say, all right, yeah, you get a 2-2 over the next two turns, but I'm going to kill you by trading attackers in the meantime. And I think maybe that kind of comes down to why I'm different on these cards, but definitely a really popular card that people are very excited about. Here's one I think people should be more excited about that has a very interesting spread across the Pauper, Peasant, and Unrestricted categories. I am talking about Search Party Captain. This is 3 and a white for a 2-2. When it enters the battlefield, you draw a card, and it costs one less to cast for each creature you attacked with this turn. So, on its ceiling, a 1-mana 2-2 that draws a card, which is obviously quite appealing, and then more expensive if you aren't able to attack with other creatures. I mentioned the spread was kind of wild, so we're looking at 78% of our Pauper testers playing this card, 35% of our Peasant testers playing this card, and then perilously few Unrestricted testers. I counted about 4% of our Unrestricted testers that are interested in playing with this card. A question for the panel. When is this card bad?
So what I want to say right away is it's not great when you're top decking it late and you don't have a bunch of creatures to attack with and reduce the cost of it. But if you're top decking it late, you can also just cast it.
Yeah. I as I was making notes for this episode, was kind of talking myself into testing this card, even though I'm among the 96% of Unrestricted Cube designers that did not include it in my testing list. And the reason is because it's hard to think of when it's really bad. I guess it's really bad when it's still the early game, and also you're stalled out. You can't attack. And that's a situation
that's
that
just a bad situation. I'm
that's
sorry,
a situation
friend.
That aggro deck really doesn't want to be in ever, and it's hard to imagine very many cards being really good in that situation. I mean, I guess maybe a removal spell might make it so you can attack, and so you'd rather have that there. Maybe you'd rather have a Banisher Priest, which removes and let you attack and also puts a body on board.
Maybe a Giant Growth.
A Giant Growth, for example, always makes you be able to attack. Your attacks are never bad for you. It creates all sorts of interesting decisions, like always attack all the time, because it's impossible for attacks to be bad. I don't know. I think this card is really interesting, and I'm fascinated by the fact that I think our number of power-motivated cube designers that are responding to this survey are pretty evenly distributed across all the rarity restrictions. When I look at the peasant lists and pauper lists that are mostly responding, they're mostly power-motivated pauper and peasant lists. And those are cubes that play very powerful cards like Lightning Bolt and all these cheap cantrips that are really powerful. I feel like this card might be better at unrestricted power levels than people are giving it credit for. I think they might be looking at it as a 4-drop and saying, well, at Rare and Mythic Rare, I can play all kinds of broken 4-drops. Why would I play this instead of an Elspeth? And it's like, well, because you cast it for 2.
Yeah, I do think that, you know, the survey definitely does skew towards the powerful cards. And so if we're looking at it through that lens, I think that this card is underrated. I think that there's so many times where it's just going to be a 2-mana 2-2 that draws a card. From a design perspective, I actually really like that. I like that it is a card that generates card advantage, but not by just putting up walls and dirtling around. It actually asks you to be proactive and then rewards you in a big way for it.
Yeah, I like the design too. So I don't know. I might. This is the kind of card that I would not be surprised if it really outperformed my expectations for it. Which I guess is maybe not how the word expectations is defined. Because if I wouldn't be surprised by it outperforming, then maybe that's my expectation. The band in which this card's performance would be not surprising to me is very wide. If you tell me this card is actually kind of messed up and broken, I would not be totally shocked to find that out. And if you tell me it's actually quite forgettable, then I would also be like, yeah, I guess that kind of makes sense. It does cost 4 mana sometimes.
Yeah, I think there is a situation in which this card is bad, and it's when you're competing at the 2 mana slot with cards like Dark Confidant, Stoneforge Mystic, Clarion Spirit, and even gold cards such as Baleful Strix. I will not be testing this card, and you almost convinced me, Andy, but then I realized, wait, I could...
Then I realized that guy's stupid.
Well, not quite. I just realized that you could take on no deck building risks. I don't have to be aggressive. I don't have to attack turns 1 and 2 with multiple creatures. And instead, I can just play Stoneforge Mystic or another really powerful 2-mana creature. So I'm not quite there, but who knows? Maybe I will be surprised.
So here's a question then. If this card were just 1 and a white for a 2-2 that drew a card, would you be excited about it then, Parker?
I think I would. I think at that point, it's probably better than Dark Confidant. It does a better job of fighting in combat, and it provides more value in the face of removal. And I think...
Also a much better top deck. Getting to draw the card immediately is a big, big game.
So I think, yeah, if it were a clean 2 mana, I would be extremely excited. But as it is, I think there's just a little too much risk.
Just... out of curiosity, I know you submitted a hot take to our call time review where you said you liked Clarion Spirit and Blood Sky Berserker specifically because they rewarded you for doing what your deck already wanted to do, which was cast multiple spells a turn. Does this not fall in the same category in that if you're playing this in an aggressive deck, you already want to be attacking with a bunch of cheap creatures and rewarding you for that is good? Or is this different somehow?
You know, it does fall into the same category, but the difference is Clarion Spirit and Blood Sky, well, I guess not Blood Sky quite as much, but especially Clarion Spirit, who I like more, can fit into any deck. And Search Party Captain only fits in white-based aggressive decks. And
that is true, I think.
That's just a narrow band for me.
Yeah, I think that's true. I would not be thrilled to play a Search Party Captain in my like green-white mid-range deck, where I am not expecting to chip in with little creatures very often. And there, you're just paying 4 mana for a 2-2 that draws a card, which I don't think is particularly exciting.
All right, let's talk about one more white card. We have Adeline Resplendent Cathar. It's a 3 mana, 1 white-white for a star 4. It has vigilance. Its power is equal to the number of creatures you control. And whenever you attack, for each opponent, create a 1-1 white human creature token that is tapped and attacking that player or a planeswalker they control. So this is kind of an interesting variant on Brumaz. Having power based on the number of creatures is another kind of way to reward you for going wide and actually keeping these tokens around. The sort of text is a little bit wonky with each opponent that, you know, I think is very relevant if you're specifically playing a multiplayer cube.
Yeah, definitely printed for Commander, it seems, given that it's a legend.
Well, and it's printed in a Magic the Gathering set. Which
oh, sure,
is...
fair.
What do you think about this card?
So, to me, the most important...
A committal squeak.
For me, the most important part of this card, in terms of the power level evaluation, is that it does make a token the turn you play it if you still attack with other creatures that turn, which is a pretty big upgrade over something like Brimaz. I think Brimaz still holds up in most power-motivated environments. Just being a 3-mana must-answer threat is pretty good. It does die to removal, though.
Dies to Doomblade.
I mean, I hate to say dies to removal, the thing that is just this kind of like throwaway thing, but it is true.
I wish you wouldn't.
It is true. If Brimaz just, you know, if your opponent untaps and flame slashes it and attacks you, then you'd pay 3 mana and got flame slashed. Adeline does offer the opportunity to generate a body that's not Adeline, generate some value beyond removal the turn she comes into play, which I think will probably pound for pound make her better than Brimaz on a power level perspective. More complexity, perhaps. She's less good at blocking, so in the aggro mirror, you'd rather have Brimaz, who can actually make a token on block as well, probably. Really narrow, I think, so I think if you are in the market for this card, it's just a matter of what you prefer, one or the other. I think, for the most part, you're putting this card in an aggressive deck, and there, it's going to be a little better for making that body the turn it comes into play, rather than having to wait to untap to get to do stuff with it.
And I should also say, this is another one of the most popular cards, with 44% of unrestricted cube designers trying it.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk about just one blue card, Puppet Stitcher. This is 3 mana for a 2/3. Whenever you cast an instant or sorcery spell, create a 2/2 black zombie creature token with decayed. So you can only attack with it one time, and it's going to die no matter what. But it also has, at the beginning of your upkeep, if you control 3 or more creature tokens, you can transform it, and you flip it over into the Puppet Factory, which says creatures you control lose all abilities and have base power and toughness 3/3. At the beginning of your upkeep, you may flip it back. So this is a really interesting kind of variant on a couple cards we've seen before, like Young Pyromancer and Murmuring Mystic. The twist is you kind of make a bunch of tokens, and then you actually get this ability to grow them into more real threats. But there is a real downside that if you don't flip it, if you can't make a bunch of tokens, they have decayed. So obviously you can use those to get value off of other, you know, effects that just use creatures, but you're not going to get as much value out of them in combat.
Yeah, that is all true of this card. This card kind of highlights for me something which is just reading true of this set the more we talk about more cards from it. I love effects that trigger when you cast spells. I have a cube where I want to encourage my players to take as many game actions as they possibly can, and I like to reward that. The fact that you can't block with those decayed zombies until you are able to flip this card, and they are just basically attackers only, and the fact that it's a blue card, I think, makes it considerably worse than a lot of these other Spells Matter variant cards you mentioned. I think it's worse than your Sedmore Witches, your Monastery Mentors, your Young Pyromancers, all these class of cards. And it's just also got a lot of text. Like, it's an effect I love, but it's got this mechanic where it flips, it does all this stuff, and you got to read all these both sides, and oh, what's the play pattern? Is it make a bunch of tokens, then flip it, then trade them all off in combat, then flip it back and make a bunch more tokens, and then, like, keep going back and forth as you can so you can finally win the game? It's, like, just really complicated for what it does compared to, like, a Murmuring Mystic, which probably not quite as powerful. Well, honestly, I think it's pretty close, given that the 1/1 birds can always block and they always have flying. But it's just so clean. It's so perfectly clean that I have a hard time getting inspired by this card.
So I haven't seen this in play, but I don't think that's correct in terms of power level. I think that this card is kind of insane. And the fact that if you're putting it in that style of deck, it also powers up all your other elemental tokens or whatever else you're making, really, I think, makes this card kind of nuts.
I think it's going to be a lot better. I should say, too, I think it's going to be a lot better in Constructed than Murmuring Mystic
was. That's a fair point.
I expect this to show up a lot in Standard because I think we build a whole deck around it. It can work. In the singleton environments where it's like, here's a little upside for the thing your deck is already doing, but you're not like 1,000% all in on playing Alvern's Epiphany and making a bunch of tokens and flipping your thing. I don't know. I think it's going to be kind of similar to like a Murmuring Mystic style card and how it's going to play out.
The thing I do really like about it, though, is it is kind of this like mini game card where it gives you a quest and the reward is big, but you kind of, even if you're not building around it in a big way, you're playing around it and you're sort of figuring out how are you going to actually get the most value. To me, I think that's an appeal. Overall, I agree that, you know, I'm probably not going to add this to any cubes for all of those like complexity reasons. And it's, yeah, I mean, it's a double-faced card. It adds a new kind of token. It's really doing a lot in terms of complexity.
It just falls flat for me. I can't justify it beyond that. Here's a card that sparked my interest, though not the interest of many other people, it seems. Our first black card is Foul Play, 1 and a black for a sorcery that says destroy target creature with power 2 or less and investigate. This is a removal spell that draws a card, which is rarefied air in terms of power level of cards. Now, it is restricted in a lot of ways. It's got a somewhat restricted mana cost at 2 mana value for destroying a small creature, which is the next restriction, only power 2 or less. And then I think the most important restriction here is that it is a sorcery. You can only do this sorcery speed. So on power level, I don't think it is the most pushed card, but I like that it is a very clean removal spell for small creatures. Limiting creatures by size, either mana value or power and toughness, is my favorite way to have a limited removal spell. And so this, I slotted into my clean cube because I think it fits in there pretty well. And I really like that it is something that plays on the tempo axis by removing a small creature early in the game when the small creatures are relevant, and also plays on the value axis by later on you can cash in that clue token, draw a card, and get the full 2-for-1 value out of your foul play. Just a card I wanted to call attention to because I think it's cool. Probably not super, super powerful, but and it's hard not to look twice at a removal spell that draws a card for me.
Investigate's also just a really fun mechanic.
It is. Why is it so fun?
I don't know. It makes little things, which are fun to have little things, and then it lets you draw cards. That's a terrible explanation, but people enjoy Investigate.
Maybe it is. It's kind of like it's like drawing a card, but 2 game actions.
Exactly,
first you make a thing, and then you draw a card later, and so it's double the game actions for the same card.
So I was a little bit disappointed to see, I think there are only, 5 cards or something that actually have Investigate in the set?
Yeah.
So I'm hoping we end up getting an influx of them, or at least a couple more in Crimson Vow.
That would be awesome. I'd love more tokens. Speaking of tokens, actually, the next black cards that we have on our list are Jadar, Ghoul Caller of Nephalia. He's a 1 and a black, 1/1 human wizard and legendary. And at the beginning of your end step, if you control no creatures with Decayed, create a 2/2 black zombie creature token with Decayed. And then the other card that is in our black category is Rotten Reunion, which is a single black mana for an instant. Exile up to one target card from a graveyard, create a 2/2 black zombie with Decayed, and it has flashback for 1 and a black. So I bring these up because we haven't really touched on the Decayed mechanic yet, and I'm wondering what you think.
We did talk about this in our mechanic episode, and the TLDL on that is that I think people are initially going to overrate the value of Decayed tokens, these 2/2s that can't block and die after they've attacked once. And here, in specifically the case of Jadar, we see an interesting implementation of this where you can get this token repeatedly. So, I mean, Jadar is kind of like, first of all, it's a 2-mana 1/1 that I don't think is going to brawl at all. You're not going to get into combat with it because you want to have it on battlefield for its ability. So unless your opponent has no blockers whatsoever, it's just going to sit back and, you know, not attack. What it basically is a 2-mana 2/2 that, if it dies, comes back every single turn. It's kind of what Jadar can be shortcutted to. And I thought this was kind of interesting, maybe for aggressive decks. I didn't actually come around putting this in my own cube, and I'm not sure if that's wrong. I still don't really know exactly how to rate this particular card.
I'm still really high on the Decayed mechanic. I think it just plays out a lot better than it reads. It being, you know, a twist on a 2-mana 2/2 zombie that is looks like a downside, I think people will really underrate the mechanic, actually, because they'll say, well, why can't this just make regular zombies? The card would be so much better.
Interesting. I think they're going to overrate it because they just underrate the downside. They're like, oh, 2/2s for this thing. It makes a 2/2 every turn.
It's possible. Write it and tell us if you're underrating or overrating the game.
Our beautiful, intelligent audience is going to be evaluating it perfectly correctly. I think that makes sense, broadly speaking.
But I think that it is actually a really interesting mechanic because there are so many ways that creatures matter that it's not just combat. So saying this Decayed token doesn't really function in combat very much just means that now you can make these much more efficient cards that do all the other stuff that creatures can do. And Jadar is a great example of that, where it's a 2-mana Ophiomancer. If you want to, you know, get that ball rolling faster and start taking advantage of all the stuff you can do, throwing away these dead bodies, this is the card for you.
It's definitely an extremely powerful card in a cube supporting an aristocrat-style deck that wants to sacrifice its creatures and do other stuff with them. I don't have that as a like marked theme in my cube, and it also hasn't been an emergent theme. There are some themes that I think emerge naturally from the cards I choose to play. This has not been a theme that has emerged naturally from the cards in my cube. And so, absent that, just as a like aggressive 2-drop, I'm kind of not that high on it, I think.
I don't think I would play it just as an aggressive 2-drop either, but I actually think that the things will come up and interactions will happen way more than you think, even if you're not explicitly trying to support this aristocrat-style deck. I actually got a chance to play with this in my pre-release deck, and there were just so many cards that, oh, this actually cares about when a creature enters the battlefield, this cares about when creatures die, and there was just always something relevant I could do with it. And the fact that you actually have the control to be able to say, well, you have a 4/4 or you have nothing, I know I can trigger both a death and an ETB in every single turn, no matter what, really gave a lot of power to the card.
Yeah, I'm with Anthony on this. I was not high on the Decayed mechanic in terms of like game design, not power level. But then I played Innistrad for the first time, and I realized that this opens up a lot of possibilities in the same way that it's just hard to design cards if the only card advantage engine you have is draw a card. If you have Scry, if you have Investigate, these are partial, like fractional pieces of card advantage, and it allows for a lot of flexibility. In the same way, I find that Decay opens up fractional pieces of a creature. And like Anthony said, you can tap them for advantage. You can trigger sacrifice abilities consistently. And I really love the kind of synergistic or tangential advantages that come from these Decayed creatures. So if I open these in a paper draft, I think I'll probably test them.
Interesting. Yeah, what I want to happen in my cube is what you're describing, Anthony. I want these kinds of themes to be kind of emergent. Like, oh, well, now that I have this card, I see that there's actually a lot of ways that I can get a little bit of edge off of it. I just haven't felt that yet. Like, for example, Ophiomerus has been in my cube forever. It's just a really good mid-range blocker. Like, it just says your aggro deck better have a removal spell or it's gonna be really hard to get through on the ground. And I have not found, other than Skull Clamp, which doesn't really work with Jadar as well. So, I mean, it does actually, because you can make equip it and attack. So, well, maybe it does work.
It works pretty well.
Yeah, it does work. Other than like Skull Clamp, there hasn't been any other, like, ooh, look what I did with Ophiomancer moments in my cube. So that's, I guess, why maybe I'm a little low on Jadar.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely going to depend on the context a lot, right? Like, your cube is nothing like Midnight Hunt Limited, for example.
Very, very true. Moving on to red, there is a modal spell I'm very interested in from this set, which is called Cathartic Pyre. One in a red for an instant. It either deals 3 damage to target creature or planeswalker, or you discard up to 2 cards, then draw that many cards. So, on its face, it's a lightning strike that can't go face with this potential other mode of looting through some chunk of your hand. It's worth noting that looting mode is pretty poor because you're already discarding this card, which you just cast, and then you have to discard other cards to draw one less card, basically. Like, if you compare this to a Tormenting Voice, in which you discard one card and draw 2, that basically replaces the Tormenting Voice and the card you discarded. This, you're going to be down a card on this transaction, no matter how many cards you discard to Cathartic Pyre to draw more. So that, to me, feels like a real ripcord in case of emergency. You know, you're flooded out or whatever, or you are mana screwed, you desperately need lands, you can start pitching cards to draw them. But I think the main mode here is obviously going to be the destroy target creature or planeswalker mode, basically, by dealing 3 damage to it.
I totally agree. When I saw this card, I was actually pretty excited about it at first because I really do kind of like those like Thrill of Possibility style cards where you're not necessarily generating card advantage, but it gives you some card selection in the late game. It gives you ways to interact with the graveyard and ways to, or motivation to think about whether or not you're playing your lands and stuff like that.
And spell triggers.
And then I thought about it more and I was like, well, what are the situations where this, you know, especially in my lower powered cube, what are the situations where the burn spell is not going to be the card you want and it's actually going to be worth going down a card in order to sculpt your hand a little bit? That just seems like it's going to come up almost never. And it's just, again, another situation where I think that that just makes this card a lot more complex than it's actually going to play out.
I think situations will come up, and those situations would be like, it comes up not that infrequently in my experience, at least in my own environment, that you're like, I'm going to point this burn spell at your face, not for lethal, but just because there's nothing else to point it at. We're in a stalled state or whatever. I'm just going to burn spell your face. And instead of this knocking your opponent down 3 life like a lightning strike would, it lets you draw more cards to get you out of that weird, you know, either we're both top decking or the board is stalled in a way that a removal spell is not going to change the fact that the board is stalled. And so I think it will come up, but it's not a very powerful mode. The first mode is like 95% of the power of this card, and that secondary mode is like, if I need to, I can I can pop this ripcord.
Burn this pyre.
Yeah. Cathartic Pyre, tested by 36% of our unrestricted cube designers, 47% of our peasant cube designers. So people are excited about that card, I think. And I might give it a try. I don't know. I like modal spells, even though that second mode is pretty suspect. It's kind of interesting to me. Here's a card that is not being particularly highly tested, but I still want to discuss. And that's Flame Channeler. It is 1 and a red for a 2/2. And whenever a spell you control deals damage, period, to any target, transform Flame Channeler, and it transforms into a 3/3. And on the flip, on the 3/3 side, whenever a spell you control deals damage, you put a flame counter on the new creature, which is called Embodiment of Flame. And you can pay a generic mana and remove a flame counter to do an impulsive draw. Exile the top card of your library. You may play that card this turn. A couple weeks back, we had a pretty long discussion about this on the Discord, and I don't like the design of this card from a design perspective. Designer hat on now, put power level aside. I don't love the design of this card for just going in any deck with burn spells, which is many red decks and many cubes, and just having this like upside that will happen sometimes, but doesn't actually really ask you to build around it or play around it. Like, I think this is the kind of card that has upside, but it's basically never going to change your draft picks or sequencing. It's just going to be a 2/2 sometimes, and you're not going to be able to flip it, and you're going to feel bad, or it's going to flip into a 3/3, which is a darn good rate, and maybe even get you some impulsive draws every now and then. But from a design perspective, putting power level aside, I just don't love that this is a card that has a bunch of text, has a bunch of complexity, has a bunch of interest, in the sense there's a lot of things you could potentially care about, but all it actually cares about is a red deck doing red deck things, and then just does a bunch of stuff.
I mean, but what's more fun than doing a bunch of stuff?
I think it's important that the stuff you do matters. And if you're doing a bunch of stuff that doesn't really matter, I don't know. This card actually is tested by fewer people than I expected. I think it is pretty powerful if you can flip it. I mean, 2-mana 3-3 that draws cards in the late game seems very good. And my expectation is that a lot of cube designers out there are supporting a red aggressive deck with lots of burn spells. But only 8% of our unrestricted cube designers are testing this card. But 21% of peasant cube designers. So maybe it will show up in peasant and people will like it there. Moving on to green, the first card I want to talk about here is Augur of Autumn. This is drawing some comparisons to Courser of Kruphix because it has the same mana cost. It is one green-green. It's a 2-3 instead of a 2-4. It also allows you to play lands off the top of your library, like Courser of Kruphix, though notably it doesn't reveal those, which I think is... I welcome this change of playing cards off the top of your library, where the older style Future Sight effects, like on Future Sight itself, in Courser of Kruphix, you have to play the top card revealed. Now most of these effects just let you look at it whenever you want and play it if you want, which I think is an improvement over that. This one also has Coven. As long as you control three or more creatures with different powers, you can also cast creature spells off the top of your library. I was impressed with this card. I mean, obviously this card is very good in Retail Limited, but it even overperformed what I expected it to in Retail Limited, just in terms of Coven overall has been easier to turn on than I anticipated it being, or has felt easier to turn on in games. And so I kind of like that from a design perspective, this is like a Courser of Kruphix, but it is not as polarized. Courser of Kruphix is really good against aggro because that 4 toughness is a big difference between the 3 toughness. It can block a lot more things than live. It dies to less burn spells. And then you also just gain life off the lands you play, which is kind of like insult to injury to the burn deck that's already stuffed out by a 3-mana 2-4. But then against control decks, it gets you a little bit of card advantage from playing the lands off the top, but it's kind of limited. It can really gain you one card a turn at max. On average, it's probably going to be half a card a turn or something. The Augur of Autumn, if you are in a sort of stalled out board where your opponent's a control deck and they're blocking you out with planeswalkers or tokens or something, you can very reasonably turn on Coven, and then just this becomes a much bigger problem for a control deck than I think the Courser of Kruphix is, which might make this nice in that it is a little better in the worst matchup and a little worse in the better matchup than something like Courser of Kruphix, and might fit into a nice slot there.
Yeah, I think the big difficult question that's a little bit hard to answer for me and is going to be context dependent is how easy it is to actually turn on that second ability.
Yeah.
But once you do, I mean, being able to play both lands and spells just can generate so much card advantage.
Something I have felt in recent drafts of my cube, the things in green that say they care about creatures or land spells, right? Like either the draw spells like Oath of Nissa that get creatures or lands, also gets planeswalkers, or Once Upon a Time, which gets creatures and lands, that kind of stuff. More and more, my threats are both planeswalkers, but also stuff like Asika's Chariot and enchantments like Primordial Mist and things like that, where I'm feeling that whiffing on creatures being a little more relevant than it has been in the past in my cube. And so I'm a little wary of that. I'm expecting that my mid-range deck is basically going to use that Coven mode if it is able to turn it on, obviously to get through lands, and then also to like churn through the mana dorks that would otherwise be dead draws. But a lot of the things you're going to hit that are actual gas might still be misses on the creature and land type limitation. This card is being tested by 37% of our unrestricted cube designers. Parker, what do you think of Augur of Autumn? You are not on Courser of Kruphix, correct?
I actually tested it quite recently and enjoyed it, and now I'm on Courser of Kruphix. I'm on Radha Heart of Keld, which is, I think, the one that also does that. And you've convinced me to try Augur of Autumn, combined with the fact that I love the alternate showcase art. Again, I'm just a sucker for pretty pieces of cardboard. And my favorite line of text in Magic is, you may do something anytime, because I just love to.
that nothing better. Line of text we see all so often.
Yeah, I'm like, okay, you're going to crack your clue. Hang on, I'm going to look at the top card of my library. And then my opponent says, okay, I'm going to draw a card. And I say, well, I'm going to look.
Am I missing something? What is the showcase Augur of Autumn? I don't think it exists, right?
I think it's the Coven Warlock frame, but I could be wrong.
I'm looking at Scryfall. According to Scryfall, there's 4 versions, but they all have exactly the same art.
What?
If there is a beautiful one, then I want it for sure.
There's a beautiful version that exists only in your mind, Parker, and we need to see it. Please design this card for us.
Coming soon to an Etsy store near you.
So I mean, on power level, I think the card is good. I'm mostly not thinking about power level. I'm thinking about how does this relate to Core Serve Crucifix. And I have to admit, like, I have this familiarity bias from playing with Core Serve for so many years where I'm like, I love this card. This card is exactly what I want my green decks to do. And so abandoning it for a similar card, or I guess you could just play both if you wanted to play both. But it feels like this is kind of like a knockoff Core Serve Crucifix in a weird way. But I actually think that the way it's going to impact games might be a net positive in my environment, because it is a little less of a hard wall against aggro and a little more of a problem for control decks.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting way to evaluate it, just making cards that are more meaningful in a lot of different contexts.
Yeah.
We can't not talk about this adorable little mushroom. So we have Deathbonnet Sprout. It's one green mana for a 1/1. At the beginning of your upkeep, mill a card. Then if there are three or more creature cards in your graveyard, transform it. And it turns into a 3/3 with, at the beginning of your upkeep, you may exile a card from a graveyard. If a creature card is exiled this way, put a 1/1 counter on Deathbonnet Hulk. This is an interesting combination of a whole bunch of little things going on. I really do like just the text of this cheap creature that mills your own library, which just gives you a lot of opportunities for interesting stuff to happen in games and for you to turn your graveyard into a resource. And then being able to turn it into a real threat that can then interact with your opponent's graveyard, that's a whole lot of stuff that can happen. I don't know how likely it is for those things to actually be relevant and for you to actually be able to transform this thing. Having not the ability to at instant speed interact with your opponent's graveyard, but just at the beginning of your upkeep. I actually could see that as an advantage in some sense.
I kind of like that, actually,
it
honestly.
It doesn't have that sort of like brutal, like just turning off your graveyard that Scavenging Ooze can have, but still gives you a meaningful way to interact with it. I mean, bottom line, I love that it's a beautiful little mushroom.
I've been thinking more and more about Grave Hate in my own environment, and I really like the onboard Grave Hate, where it's like, this is a thing. It can happen to you. I feel like it's the right balance of, we talked about a lot about expectations in our Feel Bad episode and about how you should have certain expectations around the riskiness of a play. And my feeling of like the instant speed, hidden information, cling to dust being a feel bad, because that's the one instant speed way to interact with graveyards from hidden information in my entire environment and probably in most cubes that are including cling to dust. Your opponent could reasonably think, all right, well, the chances that this goes wrong are slim because there's only the one card that could potentially make this happen. The graveyard, I think, being a space that can be interacted with in multiple ways, but I feel really good about those ways being on board, whether it's the Black Manland from Adventures in Forgotten Realms, whether it's a Scavenging Ooze, whether it's this Deathbonnet Sprout, or that white 3/2 from this set we didn't put on our list of cards to talk about. And that feels like the right amount of, like, your graveyard is the thing. It's a public information space, and therefore the ways to interact with it are going to be public information, is kind of a heuristic that I've been happy with in my own cube musings. This card, I think, could be extremely powerful. I would not be surprised if someone told me in a couple months this was like messed up and constructed, this Deathbonnet Sprout.
Oh, I could see that.
It could be a one. I mean, it's a one mana 3/3 that just it has upside.
It's a one mana 8/8.
Yeah. So
there's no ceiling here.
So that card, I think, could be very powerful. And I think most of the 13% of cube designers that are testing this card probably have pretty deep self-mill and graveyard matters themes, I'm guessing. But I also think this could just be good in a regular environment. The fact that it only cares about creature cards flipping, I think, is the big power level limitation. If this counted fetch lands and cantrips and stuff, this would be a really powerful just card. But the fact that it cares about just creature cards means you do have to be doing something very specific to turn it on.
I do like that this is just another really efficient sort of option for very proactive green decks. So even though it's a lot of fun to sort of do the ramp thing that is the feature of, or sort of the focus of the green section of a lot of cubes, having this alternative for these more like proactive strategies with things like Pelt Collector is just another interesting option.
Slowgurk, the Overslime, one green and a blue for a legendary creature ooze, 3/3. It has trample. It has whenever a land card is put into your graveyard from anywhere, put a +1/+1 counter on Slowgurk. Remove 3 +1/+1 counters from Slowgurk to return it to its owner's hand. And when it leaves the battlefield, return up to 3 target land cards from your graveyard to your hand. I love that this card triggers on leaving the battlefield, not death. I love that it interacts with lands in the graveyard. I run 3 cycles of fetch lands, and so I think that'll be really relevant. I also just added Urza's Saga, and I'm really excited for that interaction.
Yikes!
And finally, I am excited that this is a 3-mana creature in Simic that you have to commit to the board and build around. And I think the same could not be said for the other 3-mana Simic things I'm running such as Uro and Oko. I'm excited to force a little bit of commitment from my drafters with Slowgurk.
I think his card is very powerful with Broken Singleton on fetches, especially triple fetches where you're at. So this card, I think, was a bit of underrepresented in the survey. Do you think that indicates that people are just not looking for Simic cards because of all of the extremely powerful options we've gotten in the past 2 years? Or do you think it's overlooked?
Yeah, I think it's probably due to the caps that many designers put on the size of their gold sections. I personally don't cap my gold sections because I think gold cards are just a lot of fun to play with. And my mana base can support an arbitrary number of gold cards. And so I'm pumped for it. I don't have to make any cuts to play Slowgurk. And I think that's why it's such an easy inclusion for me.
Do you think there's a whole committee that just is responsible for naming ooze creatures? I feel like they must have so much fun with that.
I don't think it could exist because I would be on it if it did.
I feel like they make a lot of weird one-off committees inside WotC. I would not be surprised if there was a ooze naming committee that assembles inside of the creative team just to name oozes. One last card here. It is our only colorless card. It is a card that I think maybe is a little overlooked. And also, it is the card that is the most contentious of the cards on our survey in terms of people disagreeing on their rating of the card. I am talking about Jack-O-Lantern. This is a one mana artifact. It has an activated ability. You can pay one and tap it and sacrifice Jack-O-Lantern to exile up to one target card from a graveyard and draw a card. And then the second activated ability only works in the graveyard. You can pay one and exile Jack-O-Lantern from your graveyard to add one mana of any color. This card is weird. Very strange. I don't understand the flavor of why a Jack-O-Lantern does this. But I am starting to get quite high on just any kind of Chromatic Star-esque card, you know, an artifact that just kind of replaces itself and easy to slot into your deck somehow with upside. The upside here of like targeted Grave Hate could be very relevant in some circumstances, as we've talked about. And then the weird upside of getting to filter your mana from the graveyard as opposed to in play, like a Chromatic Star or Sphere. You know, I think it's a little worse than those, but if you have a lot of graveyard matter stuff in your cube, even if it's just incidental, not like a whole theme, but you just have a lot of flashback or, you know, ways to buy back spells from the graveyard, I think this card is a very main deckable hate for that kind of effect. And it will just like work if you have any kind of artifact theme, if you have any kind of Delirium or Threshold or something like that going on. This card does a lot of stuff. And of course, it's also worth noting it is going to be an immediate all-star in the Turbo Cube.
I might be a little bit to blame for the contentiousness of this card because that's an immediate 3.0 in the Turbo Cube.
Only being tested by 4% of our respondents. And like I said, one of the most contentious cards, partially because of Anthony, but not entirely because of Anthony. Some other people there are also rating this card very highly or very lowly. I think entirely depending on how much you appreciate these kind of cards that could just kind of be slotted into any deck and just kind of, they're filler. And I don't say it in a bad way. Like, this deck is going to enable the rest of your deck to do its thing more reliably, like any kind of cantrip and mana fixing does, at a pretty low cost.
I'm disappointed I can't think of a Smashing Pumpkins joke.
Now I'm trying to do the same thing.
I'm looking through all their albums.
The problem is I only know like three Smashing Pumpkins songs off the top of my head.
I listened to a lot of Smashing Pumpkins at some point.
I should say that this is one of the most popular sets that we've covered as Lucky Paper. Second only to Modern Horizons 2, people are testing a lot of cards from this set. And so if you are disappointed we didn't talk about something, or if you're wondering if you missed something, it's definitely worth a look through the spoiler to dig through this set because it runs deep and the cube community has been really excited about.
Yeah, and just to clarify, you mean in terms of the number of cards people are testing on average, not the number of responses. That's response count agnostic, that popularity you're describing.
That's right. The median number of cards being tested by our respondents for Innistrad is 13, which is just a huge amount.
That's
for
a lot.
Recent sets, and actually just, yeah, historically it's
yeah,
a lot.
I don't know.
Cards.
I mean, what do you think of this set in summary, Anthony, for cube broadly speaking?
So in summary, I feel like we see this pretty much every set, that a lot of these set mechanics are really designed for limited or for standard, where they're going to appear in high volume and you can have duplicates. And for those reasons, a lot of times they're just not the exact thing that we're looking for a lot of cubes. But there's a whole bunch of depth and just a lot of interesting small twists on other mechanics, and also potentially just adding a density of some of these things like Disturb that might make some things like double face cards more appealing. I'm going to go ahead and go three and a half forks.
Three forks, two times.
Wow.
As I've kind of intimated throughout this episode, I found myself largely uninspired by this set. I mean, there are a fair number of cards I'm adding to my cube. A lot of them fall into the category of very known quantities. I just like Consider. I just like Infernal Grasp. I just like Faithful Absence. None of those cards are going to change the texture or shape of my environment. They're just going to help me exactly tweak and tune the power level and the densities of interaction and stuff I want, but they're not inspiring to me. And the rest of the set, I feel like the power level was put into places that are not conducive to a lot of cube environments, in that they were put into Daybound Nightbound cards, they were put into various double face cards. Mechanics like Disturb, which I think are really clean, didn't get really pushed cards for power motivated cube designers, so we don't see a lot of those show up in the set, even though that's probably my favorite mechanic from the set overall. Flashback, again, didn't get any cards we even talked about. I think the most popular card was like Sacred Fire, which is the Boros Firebolt that also gains you some life when you cast it, which is a perfectly fine card. But again, the cards all fell into either way too complicated, way too much going on for it to be worth the investment, or this category of like just kind of tweaked version of a known quantity for me. I didn't feel myself, I'm not in love with any of these cards. I'm really hard pressed to name my favorite card from this set.
Jack-o'-lantern. You love Jack-o'-lantern.
I guess if I had to choose a favorite card from the set, it would be Infernal Grasp or Consider, which just says a lot. I mean, I don't just pick favorite cards based on their playability. Like, oftentimes I have an emotional connection to a card. I just don't feel that for any of these cards, really.
For me, Consider is probably it, just because it's a card I've wanted to see for a long time. It does a lot for a very low cost of inclusion. The other card that I really love is Flesh Taker, which we didn't talk about, but it's just an awesome black-white card. It's got excellent art from all-star prolific Magic artist Kev Walker, and it just fits really neatly into this package, where it benefits from other things being sacrificed, but also fuels itself. I'm really excited to see how it plays.
My favorite card is Arlen, the Pax Hope. For all the reasons we talked about, I just think it's a really neat, self-contained package, and I'm excited to play with it.
That is our Innistrad Midnight Hunt review. Do not forget to go to luckypaper.co and check out the brilliant perspective that Parker has written. With all of this data analyzed, you can go look at the numbers for yourself and also look at all the cards we didn't have time to talk about and see how the community breaks down on them. All of our music is produced by DJ James Nasty. All of the Magic cards are produced by Wizards of the Coast. This podcast is produced by speaking into microphones and calling Parker on Zoom so he can speak into his microphone all the way from Philadelphia. Thanks to both of you for talking about Innistrad Midnight Hunt with me. This happened last time, too, where you both just sat and waited for someone to say something.
I was going to give...
Sorry, I was...
Both being too generous. Too generous.